Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I recently noticed an article in Politico magazine titled "Everyone in Congress is Obsessed with This Book About the Post-Civil War Era." The book is The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. The author, John Grinspan, will join us today. We're also going to talk about his latest book, Wide Awake, The Forgotten Force That Elected Lincoln and Spurred the Civil War. John Grinspan is curator of the political history at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. He's author of the award-winning The Virgin Vote, How Young Americans Made Democracy Social, Politics Personal, and Voting Popular in the 19th Century. He frequently contributes to the New York Times. He's been featured in the New Yorker, Washington Post, and elsewhere, and he lives in Washington, D.C., and joins us now. John Grinspan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So I read that article and I thought, well, I'm not a elected official on Capitol Hill, but I want to talk about this. I know our audience will be interested, so thank you so much for coming on here. So let me just read this kind of to set the scene, and it'll tell people why so many politicians kind of wanted to pick your brain. So we're talking about a period of technological disruption, high immigration rates, close presidential races, high turnout, anger metastasizing into violence. That could describe our times, but it also describes the time that you write about in this book, the late 19th century.
It's amazing how much our politics and our culture have come to look like something we saw 140 years ago forgot about and are rebuilding the basic building blocks of.
We're all trying to understand this, and I guess you would caution us, you can't really tell us what our future will be, right? Even looking at the past. But I can definitely tell why so many politicians reached out to you, including Senator Romney here from Utah, incoming Senator Kim from New Jersey, Senator Blunt. Many reached out to you. What did they most want to know?
Well, I think part of it is they like history. And people who go into public life and governance also often like history and are curious about the past. So I really don't think I have any advice to give any lawmakers, right? I mean, historians study the past, not the present or the future. So I wouldn't claim to know what anyone should do now. But we do have these really interesting parallels to a forgotten period in our history, arguably the most forgotten period in our history, that was formative for our democracy, set up the stage for what we considered normal politics and kind of forgot about. So we have all this useful precedence for what we're going through right now. And yet we constantly say things are unprecedented, when really, if you study this past, you can see real clear parallels. And that is at least useful in knowing that we're not driving the car off the cliff, that we've been, if not here before, similar places before. And they managed to address them in the past, and we probably will in the future as well.
I want to just do some more, not so much parallel, but illustrating that in some ways that period was worse than ours, which is comforting in an odd way, right?
Yeah.
So in the years after Appomattox, it included a presidential impeachment, three presidential assassinations, and you say the boys born on the day Lincoln died were not old enough to vote when James Garfield was shot in 1881. Boys born on that day were not yet voters when William McKinley was murdered in 1901. Gunfire punctuated all of Philadelphia's elections between 1870 and 1900. In 1884, Republican National Committee shipped 600 revolvers to Cincinnati poll watchers. Then we mentioned the 1871 Paris Commune, 20,000 dead. I don't know, what's your view of that? I find that oddly a bit comforting, but our times are still worrying, potential violence.
It's fine. Yeah, I didn't write it to be comforting, but some people seem to find it that way because I think we're so used to what we consider normal politics, which is the calm second half of the 20th century America. So anything other than what we grew up with looks like the end of the world when really that's the norm. This combative, aggressive, partisan democracy is what we've seen throughout much of our history. For instance, to go with those numbers you cited, over the second half of the 1800s, a sitting congressman was murdered once every 7 years. Hmm. It happened a lot. In the whole 20th century, it happens three times, and it's these prominent cases of RFK's assassination or Huey Long or something like that. And it was kind of, basically cranks in the 20th century. In the 19th century, these are political rivals and that kind of thing. So we have a system that has drawn out aggression, high levels of engagement, tribalism in the past. We just haven't seen it in our lifetime. So it looks really foreign when really it's older than the kind of restrained, polite politics we would like to see.
So I guess that's the upside, right? Or some of the upsides. There are trade-offs. Very high participation in the period that you're writing about, right? High voter turnout, high interest.
Yeah, this was not just the bad old days. And it's easy to look at the past and think they were all worse back then and wilder and more barbarous or whatever. But this was an era of 80% turnout for eligible voters. And those who couldn't vote, who denied the right to vote, women, people under 21, African-Americans in many places, are still reading partisan newspapers, arguing all the issues, engaging in every way they can. So there's a really high level of engagement, especially for people who are less well off. In the 1800s, people voted at higher rates if they were poor and less educated. And people who were wealthier tended to avoid American democracy. So you have this big, noisy, engaging working class democracy that's actually really good at getting young people to engage, immigrants to engage, people who don't have college educations to engage. And at the end of this, it kind of flips. So this is not just people were wild and bad back then. This is a different model of participation that in some ways looks a little more like 21st century democracy. I mean, an easy parallel is in this last campaign, we saw the use of pro wrestlers and UFC fighters to gin up support. They used to do the same thing with bare knuckle boxers in the late 19th century. So that a lot of the things people seem to invent in 2024 were really from 1880, and we just brought them back.
Politics was bound up with identity even more then, right? We're seeing some, return to that. We had a period, kind of this sanitized version we're talking about, where you don't talk about who you vote for, right? And then you don't bring up, politics or religion in polite company. Nowadays, you got people flying Trump flags, kind of thing. I guess that was more the way it was back then.
Yeah, absolutely. You could go down the list of identities in late 19th century America and usually figure out how people would vote, whether they were Lutheran or Baptist or Catholic or Jewish, or whether they were native born or foreign born, whether they're from the South, from the North. There are all these identities that inform their tribal politics. In the 20th century, political scientists started to worry that Americans weren't partisan enough and that you really couldn't tell the difference between a Kennedy voter and a Nixon voter in 1960, that the parties seemed actually pretty similar when you got down to it. And then we've seen it emerge again as politics is kind of like an alternate identity people jump to when they feel anxious, when they feel threatened. And I think that's similar to what happened in the 19th century. Partisan identity is something you can lean into when your other identities feel like they're wobbly in a way.
So talk a little bit about the intersection between culture and politics. For example, that when politics became sanitized, as you write about, then politicians were expected to sort of take on this artifice, the honorable gentleman, that kind of thing. Whereas the people, many of the people were crass and crude. Now we have kind of a return to that, right? That's an insight maybe that Mr. Trump had. He's not putting any of that civility on that lipstick on a pig, you might say. I'm angering Trump voters right now, but anyway, you know what I'm saying.
Well, you can say it. I can't. I think you're exactly right. I think the key word here is restraint. That in the 20th century, in response to politics being ugly and violent and messy, they introduce this idea that politicians should be restrained. They should be civil. They should be kind of above the fray in a way. And if you look at 20th century politicians, even people who we know deep down weren't like this at all, tried to seem restrained in public. I mean, if you look at the first three presidents who were born in the 20th century, it's JFK, Nixon, and LBJ. And we know that in their private lives, they are not at all restrained people. In fact, they have problems with controlling their emotions. But when they go talk to the public, they try to seem as calm, as civil, as dignified as possible. And that worked for a while because it was kind of a backlash against the previous culture, kind of wildness in politics. We see in 21st century politics, the way that they say being uninhibited is kind of a superpower now, and it gains appeal and it gains attention. we don't want a boring, restrained politician who talks like a politician and like a focus group. We want someone who feels authentic. That connects back to like speakers on the stump in the 19th century. The one really key difference is that all along, the president was an outlier. The president, even in the ugliest, most violent politics in the 1800s, is expected to be a calm, sober, likable, kind of a national grandfather. They're not supposed to get their hands dirty. They don't campaign for themselves. They're not supposed to be seen as corrupt or violent or anything like that. But if you get below the level of presidents, if you look at the bosses, if you look at the senators, if you look at the people who run the campaigns, they're, to our standards, out of control. It's just the president is always set aside as virtuous until the modern era.
So politics, in this, especially presidential campaigns, you write, it was the only game in town. Now everything's fractured, but this was entertainment, right? And beyond that, it was a way of belonging. It was a group that you could belong to. That's a definite parallel to today, it seems like.
Absolutely. I mean, imagine a culture where there's not the central unifying social elements that you see in the 20th century. So there's no Super Bowl, there's no Oscars, there's no Hollywood, there's no television, there's no radio, there's no kind of uniting central culture that Americans are used to from the 20th century. But most of these people are in one way or another in the 1800s immigrants from somewhere, whether they come from England or Germany or China or Sweden, or whether they move from the East Coast to Utah or elsewhere, they've left behind some community. They don't have the village cultures, the old fashioned traditions that kind of bound people together, and they need something to unite them. And politics is big. And the presidential election is the only national thing they do, right? Everything else is regional or fractured, even the other elections. The president is the only national office. And so it's a way to have a full national conversation. And so people who want to join into some kind of conversation use, I think they still do, the presidential campaigns to argue about identity, to argue in our case about gender or religion or slavery or whatever it was back then. It kind of becomes a device, a vehicle for people who want to have that debate. At the same time, they're big, they're public, they're social. There's often liquor and booze at these events. There are fireworks, they're in the town square. Presidential elections happen in the fall when people have kind of are doing the harvesting or finishing up the harvesting and want to gather. So they really become a vehicle for all these other interests and desires of meeting, of interacting, of campaigning. People start to use this thing in all sorts of different ways.
And again, you know, certainly in the 20th century and earlier in the 21st century, we haven't really known that, right? We had this period which was, I guess you're saying, was kind of abnormal, right? An aberration. I want to read something that you said in an interview. It just struck me, the parallel to, you talked about belonging. You joined these clubs and it was movements, right? And you felt like you belonged. This is a way for immigrants and many others, the young people, to feel like they belong. Now to today, this is John Grinspan. Now, I think we all know people like this today. They'll retire or they'll lose their job, they'll get divorced, or they'll have some new thing in their life that makes them isolated, and they'll get really into watching MSNBC or Fox News or whatever. And 6 months after that thing that isolates them, they'll be so much more partisan and amped up about politics because it's always waiting for you, always wants your attention. So again, we've returned to this, I guess, era of politics as belonging.
I think so. I don't want to sound like I'm beating up on people who have a hard or isolating experience, because a lot of people experience all sorts of forms of loneliness nowadays. They're really are parallels between that and what happened in basically the Gilded Age. When you think about the average American who's left home, who's working in a factory, who's away from their communities, who's away from all their organizations, things like, we think of people in the 19th century as more religious, but church membership falls, association, like being part of civic organizations falls. People don't have the anchors for their society. I really think this social disruption is the key force driving partisanship back then and today. It's not partisanship or politics itself. It's not even the parties. It's not even income inequality. It's a sense of living in a shaken world, needing some kind of anchor for your life. And the parties are the only things that really want you. They want your vote. They want your support. They want you to advocate for you. So if you're fresh off the boat from Sweden, or if you're moving from New York to Utah or whatever it may be, you find a use for yourself in your life. And so you start reading all the political newspapers, start campaigning and going to the rallies and voting and throwing bricks at the other side. We can see that a similar thing today where people who feel disrupted, vulnerable, see in the political system a use for themselves, a role. And in one way, it's very democratic of us to think, well, I guess I'll help out with the governing of my nation. That's kind of optimistic in a way, but it also pits us against each other in a two-party system. So you can see exactly why people lean into this and also why it is harmful and kind of a downward spiral, because the more people who lean into this, the more we fight amongst ourselves.
You talk about another parallel that really struck me. In this period, the late 19th century, the presidential elections were very, very close. High turnout, elections very, very close. I think a lot of one-term presidents. Of course, we had a big parallel. President Trump has pulled a Grover Cleveland, right? He had an interregnum. But the thing that really struck me was that people then would say, this is the election. This is, you know, this is the election that really matters. And then we'd have another election, that the existential election, and obvious parallels to today.
Absolutely. There's this quote from Atlantic Monthly from the 1890s that says, one election, one party is obliterated. Every 2 years, the next party is obliterated. And we just go back and forth. And we have these hugely hyperbolic declarations of, this is a landslide, this is a mandate, when, you know, as with this last election, 2% of the population or less is deciding these elections. I really think the way we've gone back and forth recently, from most recent Republican win, very close, no one got 50% of the vote. Previously, a Democratic win, also fairly close. Before that, Democratic popular win, Republican electoral college win. This bouncing back and forth is exactly what you saw in the 1880s and 1890s, when for four straight elections, no party gets a mandate a second time. They win a couple thousand voters in key states, give them the White House, and then 4 years later, they throw the bums out and they choose the other side, and they just bounce back and forth. The really clear thing is a lack of a mandate. You look at the 20th century, you see these huge landslides, people winning by 10, 20% of the popular vote. And it's not that they were better candidates. I mean, Warren Harding was not an amazing president, but he had a huge landslide. You go back to a previous era, more capable presidents had squeakers. So it's really about how the electorate behaves, not the candidates. And we have this tendency, especially people in the media, wanting to make everything in the present feel gigantic. And so 2024 election is a close election and a small win. 2020 election was the same way. 2016 election was the same way. There's this narrative to elections that makes them want to feel cumulative. But really, if you look at the trends over time, these are squeaker after squeaker of throwing the bums out every time.
Let's take a break. We'll come back and talk more with John Grinspan. He is curator of political history at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, author most recently of Wide Awake, The Forgotten Force That Elected Lincoln and Spurred the Civil War. We'll talk about that later in the hour. Right now, we're talking about the influential book, The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. It's published in 2021. Politicians are reading this, and you probably should too. Very, very interesting parallels between that period, 1865 to 1915, and today. We'll have more with John Grinspan following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with John Grinspan. He is curator of political history at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, author of several books. The one we're talking about right now is The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. So, John Grinspan, at a certain point, influential people decided this is, despite the virtues, I guess, of high turnout, a lot of people participating, it's too messy, it's too potentially violent. And so I guess reformers got at this. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, there's a good motivation and a bad motivation at the same time. On the one hand, it is messy, it is violent, it is kind of senseless. There's not much ideology. The voters don't really know what they're voting for. And there's a really good reason to want to reform this democracy. At the same time, a lot of those same reformers don't like that this is a system that's dominated by working class people, by more and more immigrants, by more and more Catholic and Jewish immigrants or African Americans. So there's kind of a movement by upper middle class native-born Protestants, basically, who want to reform the democracy. And half is for good causes. They want to make people know who they're voting for or know what the issues are. They start to work to quiet down those big, massive rallies that were a big part of elections. And they say more thinking, less shouting in politics. And it's really admirable. At the same time, they're also specifically working with what they call the secret cause of reducing turnout and reducing engagement, especially by less wealthy and less educated people. I mean, we think of everybody always wants turnout all the time, but a movement emerges in the 1880s, 1890s to dial down turnout and dial down engagement, especially by what they would view as the wrong voters. And this kind of builds after the centennial of America. They have the celebration, 100 years. A lot of people decide the democracy is going in the wrong direction. And so they really try to make these changes in the quarter century after that. They start with really small reforms in how you can vote. They introduce things like the secret ballot, whereas before you voted in public with a ballot that was handed to you by an activist or by a newspaper printer, the government starts to print the ballot. They make it so that you vote in private by yourself with a voting curtain cutting you off rather than vote in your community so that your neighbors and your friends and your family and also your boss and the local gang leaders see how you vote. You know, it's a real change in how you behave when you vote in private versus when you vote in public. And they also kind of introduce this culture of, I guess the three key elements are privacy, independence, and restraint. Privacy, nobody should know how to vote, how you vote. Don't talk about politics at the dinner table. Independence, partisanship is actually a bad thing. You should switch between the parties as you choose. And restraint, keep those angry, heated emotions out of politics. Don't bring that into the political sphere. And with these changes, they really change the electorate, they clean up voting, they start passing key reforms, but turnout crashes by a third, so that after a generation of this, less than half of eligible voters are bothering to go vote.
Now, part of this, obviously, I assume played in with very bad motives, right? In the South, right? Blacks were able to vote after the 14th Amendment, and then they were terrorized out of the poll taxes, et cetera, out of the system. Some of this good motivations, right? Politics is too violent, etc. But the end result, I guess politics did become more civil, right? But participation rates plummeted.
Yeah, in 1896, which is kind of the last of the big elections, it's like 80% of voters go to the polls. By 1924, you know, a generation later, fewer than half of voters go to the polls, 49%. It's an amazing cultural change. And you can see it in the numbers and you can see it in the behavior. People, reporters start talking about how quiet the voting lines were and how quiet election day was and how mild and how few people went to go vote. And they say it like it's a great thing, because what that population wants is fewer people voting. They want fewer people and better people voting is how they would really say it. And it's of this culture at the same time that's pushing eugenics. It's trying to make the population, as they see it, racially better. And you know, these people create a lot of the institutions we use, and they actually do create the basics of what we consider normal democracy. So in the last couple of years, when norms are shaken and we see this model emerging, it's the falling away of an old invention. People, it's not that politics worked and then they got broken a few years ago. They worked one way and then people broke them another way, and now we're breaking them another way. It's a continuous evolution on top of evolution. And so you see these reforms that were so big 100 years ago getting rolled back. And with it, you see the return of things that I thought were gone, you know, 125 years ago are creeping back into our democracy.
We see the erosion of very recent or relatively recent reforms, right? Watergate era reforms are kind of eroding, right? The FEC, which was, you know, created for a reason, that's almost non-existent these days.
Yeah, these things are, they build on themselves. So you get a culture of reform in the early 1900s, and then you say, well, let's clean up this other institution, and let's clean up this other institution. And so it builds and builds, and by the middle of the 20th century, you have these institutions you mentioned. You have an independent investigative press that does things like dig up the Watergate scandal and tells people what's actually happening in Vietnam, and you have this era that's kind of the peak of that model of politics. And you can see one by one these institutions weakening or falling away today. And it's not that they were perfect and the founders gave them to us and we've had them for 200 years. It's that someone invented them in 1900 and by 2000, they're looking a little wobbly and people are undermining them today. And it also means, though, that we can reform our politics and we can actively, deliberately change our political culture. It's not a runaway train. And I think that is a little helpful to see these days.
So looking those two eras, three, I guess, the one you write about, late 19th century, the intervening time with the reforms now to today, what's better? Are you alarmed? Are you reassured?
You know, I try to be, this is not a popular thing to say, I try to be kind of amoral as a historian. My goal is to study what these people did and try to understand and explain it. Better is a topic. I mean, there are certain things that are horrible, right? And there are things in the past that are just beyond the bounds of acceptability. But whether it's better to participate in the political system then as now, they both have strengths and they both have weaknesses. I mean, I wouldn't want to vote at a violent, drunken polling place, but I also wouldn't want to vote at one where you can't show any interest. Or I also wouldn't want to participate in a political system where few people actually care or bother to vote and kind of have the sense of political quiet and conformity we saw in previous eras. So I think both have strengths and both have weaknesses. And the question is how you make change. How do you get out of an era where it feels like you're stuck in a loop? As they successfully did, that's, to me, the most motivating part of the story is that whether the reforms are better or worse, people looked at the political system in 1870s, 1880s and said, I want to make a change. And then generated it slowly as a cultural change over a generation so that politics looks really different after they make this reform effort. And that's motivating in a way that it really can be done.
I want to bring this back to where I started. This is where I encountered your book, was this article in Politico, which mentioned that you're talking to a bunch of politicians. So, you know, without mentioning anyone by name, in general, what did they want from you? I could imagine if I'm calling you up as an elected official, I want a little reassurance, maybe, and understanding, right? What in general did they want? Were you able to give that to them?
Yeah, I think, if you imagine, there are a couple of things. First of all, if you imagine being a politician, you think you sit at the center of leadership and power, and yet you were powerless in so many ways with this political culture. And it seems like it's running away from under you. So I think getting a sense of it happening before and successful reforms before are really important. The other thing is now, as in the Gilded Age, people really beat up on politicians. And we all act in partisan ways and tribal ways and harmful ways. And then we blame these elected leaders for how we choose to behave. So I think part of it is it's just nice to hear that it's not really your fault. It's the behavior, structural behavior of a whole society rather than a few evildoers or whatever. The other thing is this book, The Age of Acrimony, it follows the narrative of a father and daughter who are both in politics. He's a prominent congressman, and how they try to reform in different eras. So I would imagine if I were in a leadership position, reading the story of a father daughter relationship in a similar position to me would be interesting. I guess the question they most often want to ask is, how do we change it? How did they get out of this era? If they were in this loop in the Gilded Age, how did they ever get out of it?
And I'll mention that this father-daughter story is fascinating. Read the book to get that. You personalize it. Just last on this, we'll go to the other book. I just want to read this statement from that you gave from this interview. This is fascinating to me. You say, we're using the political system for something it's actually really bad at. We're using the electoral system to resolve a culture war, and it never can. The electoral system's good at putting people in power to pass or block legislation. It's terrible at deciding what pronouns we should use or whatever. And so we will never be able to resolve it because we're using a stapler as a telephone, just not designed for what we're asking it to do. Never be satisfying. So I get that part of it. It'll never be satisfying, never fully resolve. It's always a contest. But if we can't use the electoral system, political system for resolving these things, where do we go?
That's, again, beyond my pay grade. I don't know what they used to do. I guess if you think about in the Gilded Age and well into the Progressive Era, there's a really central culture war in American life between people. There are a number of different fault lines on religion, on race, on ethnicity, on kind of a forward-looking or backward-looking vision, on urban versus rural. on labor versus capital. There are all these kind of cultural fault lines, and people keep trying to fight them out over within the political system. And it usually really doesn't work. It takes until the kind of the New Deal and World War II, there's this smoothing and this calming of some of these conflicts that really raged for 50 years before that. And none of it happens because somebody won a big election. I mean, sometimes it happens during the FDR administration, but our political system, going back to Madison and the founders, is just not designed to bring this kind of massive landslide cultural change we want from it. And we see it as this kind of national town square where we can fight over these social issues, but it's really designed to do the opposite. It's really designed to kind of check the heated emotions of the mass of people. That's really, we learned about all this checks and balances in school for a reason. So expecting to win an election and make radical change in one direction or another, it's just not what it's for. And it's because it's not what it's for, it's never really going to be satisfying. It's going to make us more angry, and we're going to devote more heated, misguided emotions to it. We really need to expect cultural change from elsewhere besides from the Capitol and the White House.
Well, the book is The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. We'd highly recommend that. We'll take another break, and we'll come back with John Grinspan to talk about his latest book, Wide Awake, The Forgotten Forest That Elected Lincoln and Spurred the Civil War, talking about this line between free speech and violence, right? And this really was a key igniter of the Civil War. John Grinspan is telling us fascinating history. We'll talk about that following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with John Grinspan. He's curator of political history at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. We're going to talk now about his latest book, published this year, Wide Awake, The Forgotten Forest That Elected Lincoln and Spurred the Civil War. So, John Grinspan, you write that across diverse conflicts from college campuses, talking about today, at the Capitol steps, probably referring to January 6th, we keep asking where the line is between heated words and aggressive deeds. And it's a question that fueled America's bloodiest war, you write. The Civil War is fought over slavery. Anyone who says it wasn't is just wrong. But how did American slavery, which began in 1619, spark a conflict in 1861? How did a long-running debate turn into a shooting war? Where exactly was the dynamic moment when the argument became a fight? So that's a theme, the main theme in the Wide Awake. So you're talking about the Wide Awakes. Well, tell me what the Wide Awakes were.
Yeah, this is this amazing mass movement that is not well known, but it is, I think, the among the largest, strangest, and most consequential political organizations in our history. It's a gigantic youth movement in the election before the Civil War, the election of 1860, where young men throughout the North and West and a little into the South put on military uniforms and march at night with torches against slavery's threat to democracy. And they become this gigantic movement. They really excite people. They help elect Abe Lincoln. But they also really scare their opponents and help spark civil war. And this mass movement kind of, as you mentioned in your introduction, really tests the line between what is speech or and what is a symbol, marching around in a military uniform, and what is violence and preparation for violence. Because these guys, within a year of putting on these military uniforms, are fighting in the Union Army. And they talk about themselves as an army. They talk about themselves as a force. Their opponents certainly see themselves as see the Wide Awakes as a preparation for an invasion of the South. So where is that line in our democracy between saying something and doing something? And I think they're just a fascinating story, especially because they're so little known.
So you write that you quote Frederick Douglass, slavery, he said, cannot tolerate free speech. And indeed, there is a lot of coercion, a lot of pushback to, you know, speaking out against slavery. And then there's a backlash. So that interesting that line, right? The right to free speech, the right to protest, the right to march. Then where does that morph into violence? So I guess maybe first of all, talk about this pushback. Sometimes coercion. Yeah, you know, you can't talk about slavery.
Coercion's the key word. This is exactly, and both sides are saying you're coercing me. You're shutting down my free speech. You can't publicly criticize slavery. Certainly in the South. I mean, that is a warrant for expulsion, if not getting lynched. But in much of the lower half of the North, in your Philadelphias, your New Yorks, well up into Connecticut and out into Illinois, people who are prominent critics of slavery they get their newspaper presses thrown in the rivers. They sometimes get murdered. They get tarred in feathers. There's open violence in the streets against critics of slavery. And this is at a time in the years before the Civil War when there's open political violence in general. You have the Know-Nothings. You have all these different gangs with names like the Blood Tubs and you know, kind of this, think of gangs of New York. You get this kind of violent public politics going on. And the wide awakes emerge in the North to push back against that, to first to protect as bodyguards anti-slavery speakers like Abe Lincoln, who they happen to protect on their first march. And they start to spread this militaristic vision of defending anti-slavery free speech until they really spread across the North and they start to butt up in the South against places where they also have slavery. And you really take your life in your hand to be a wide awake in Baltimore or Washington, D.C. or St. Louis. Some of them turn into paramilitary organizations and really lead to the opening round of the Civil War. Others kind of skirt this line between, are they a club where they just get together and hang out, or are they a real threat? And they kind of affect all the leadership of the political parties. Abe Lincoln doesn't quite know what to do with them, and they become really the most prominent political organization in our history, spark the Civil War, and then we've totally forgotten about them for the most part. So it's kind of fun to excavate this history that was so important and also so forgotten.
Why did we forget about them?
That's a good question. There are a couple of things. One is we have a Civil War right afterwards, and that's pretty big. If you're wide awake in 1860 and you fight in the Union Army in 61, seeing combat, living through that experience is just the thing you talk about afterwards. It's bigger, uncontestably. The other thing is the wide awakes present a really dark vision of democracy because they're so militaristic, because they're marching around in these uniforms and talking about invasion, and because they're seen as crossing that line between politics and paramilitary violence, it's not a very happy story to tell. So after the war, when Americans are trying to have reunion and get along together, it's easier to talk about Abe Lincoln and, you know, splitting rails and being a riverboat pilot and all these kind of nice folksy Lincoln things than it is to talk about these guys in military uniforms marching in the night with torches. That kind of digs up all the darkest parts of our democracy. But in recent years, feels more relevant, I think. I've been researching them for 17 years, but I really started writing the book after Charlottesville and seeing what it looks like to see people marching with torches in the night again. You know, it got me thinking about the whole movement in a different light, honestly.
Yeah, obvious parallels. I want to read this. I think it's so well written. You wrote an article. You say, this is John Grinspan, Americans have taught themselves an oddly cozy account of their Civil War, jumping from genteel orators debating the peculiar institution to blue and gray soldiers arrayed on Virginia cornfields all set to mournful fiddle music. I guess Ken Burns is to blame, I guess, for some of this. But I guess we it's not the only occasion when we do this, right? We want our history to kind of fit our sensibilities.
Yes, that's true. And we want it to be something we can talk about with 10-year-olds and kind of feel big feelings about. But the Civil War is a political civil war that emerged from an incredibly ugly institution and led to massive violence. And I think the way we've told ourselves it is this account that's totally bloodless and in a way almost conflictless, so that people have trouble imagining how people, especially how Northerners, could want to go fight for the Union Army. Like, why bother if it's just, you know, this cozy vision of the war? And it really takes the wide awakes help kind of excavate again why they were feeling so heated up in 1860, 1861, why it felt like free speech was a needed defense, why it felt first and foremost what like democracy was under defense. Because this is what the Union Army is fighting for. This is what Lincoln is fighting for in the wide awakes, the sense that slavery is threatening to kill democracy. That's what he says in the Gettysburg Address, basically. And going backwards to the election before it, there's a sense that slavery is undermining democracy itself. And that's what these people are so fired up about.
It's very interesting who's in the wide awakes. Some people estimated it was, what, 500,000? You say it may not have been that, but very prominent groups all over. Who were in the wide awakes?
Yeah, it's a great question. People think they're 500,000 wide awakes. I think that number's wrong, but in a kind of diffuse nation where you really can't do a head count, 500,000 wide awakes in a country of 31 million people is a lot of people. It'd be like there were a movement of 5 million people today. We haven't had a 5 million person mass movement in quite some time. The Wide Awakes start out as young working class guys, really they're youths. They're people in their late teens and 20s who have all this energy, and they've grown up in a culture that really they've witnessed politics crumbling. Parties die, the Whig Party dies, the Know-Nothings rise and fall, the Democratic Party is falling apart. They've grown up their whole youth with a sense that their democracy is really in danger. Open political violence, it looks like slave owners run the whole country basically. And so they start signing up in these clubs and putting on these uniforms and marching at night with torches as kind of a defense, because they feel like their whole childhood they've watched institutions crumble. And I think you could, it's not exactly the same, but you could find young people today, 18-year-olds, 22-year-olds, who feel that way about the politics they've witnessed. So the sense of needing to wake up, to kind of stand up, to really be, to push back against the threats to your life and your society, I think we can in some ways empathize with it or understand it.
So you say the textbooks use the passive phrase, the coming of the Civil War, but you say the war didn't come. Americans brought it, argued it, protested it into being. This book, you help explain how that happened.
Yeah, I try to at least. I mean, we have this vision of like, well, it's time for the Civil War to start. But it always was hard for me to understand how they got from this political dispute over slavery that had lasted for centuries to shooting each other in Virginia and Maryland and Tennessee and all over. And really, the Wide Awakes helped tell the story and connect the dots. Because they're a political organization, they go from a militaristic political organization into an actual military organization. You can follow them from 1860 to 1861. Becoming this mass movement, getting people fired up, helping to elect Lincoln, helping to bring about secession. And then these guys are the first guys to sign up in the Union Army to fight against secession. So you can really connect the dots and see how they're feeling the whole way, rather than you have your lesson on the politics of the 1850s, and then next week you learn about the first Battle of Bull Run or whatever. It really is one contiguous political event. And I think seeing it that way helps understand how people could keep escalating their passions and spiraling their politics and end up in civil war.
So the book is Wide Awake, the Forgotten Force that elected Lincoln and secured the spurred the Civil War. Well worth reading, along with The Age of Acrimony. Just a couple of minutes left, John Grinspan. I wanted to get to this. You wrote an article as part of a series of articles on the one-year anniversary of January 6th. It was published in the New York Times January 6th, 2022. I'll just quote you. Talking about the insurrectionists, the rioters, their names will live in infamy. History, we want to believe, will judge them harshly. History, however, may have other plans. You have this vision where maybe the QAnon shaman, you know, his headdress will be there, and he won't live in infamy. History, we think history will judge in a certain way, but often it doesn't.
Yeah, we have no control over that, right? I mean, the main thing one should have as a historian is humility, to know that the only rule is change, and what you think is going to happen and what you think is up is down, and what you think is down will end up up. We really can't shape that too much. And so we look back over our history. I wrote this with my colleague, Peter Manso, who started with the thought experiment about the shaman, the QAnon shaman in the Capitol Rotunda, a statue of him. And we thought about all the moments in history where it seems like the judgment of history is clear, and all the objects in the Smithsonian collection that seem like clearly good, clearly bad, and how they've been recast in different ways at different times. And thought about Jefferson Davis, who's president of the Confederacy, led a treasonous movement that killed more American soldiers than anyone else in our history. And within a lifetime, his statue is back in the Capitol Rotunda as a hero. So there are roads named Jeff Davis all over the South and the not South too. So the way we think history is going to go will unfold, we just can't predict. And that knowledge that there is no right side of history, there's no sense that the arc of the moral universe bends one way or another, it really, human history just keeps unfolding, and people keep coming up with new wild interpretations that serve some goal that we can't anticipate yet. So the arrogance, honestly, that we think we can know the direction of history is something that makes it harder for us to really see how human history unfolds, I think.
Well, much more we could say. We're out of time. A fascinating discussion. Thank you so much. John Grinspan is a curator of political history at Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. We've been talking about his two latest books, The Age of Acrimony and Wide Awake, both well worth reading. He's author of a couple other books as well. You can check those out as well. John Grinspan, thank you so much for the conversation.
Oh, thank you, Tom. This was great.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll go out as we do on Tuesdays with Crossroads. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Every rural person and place has a story. Change is part of that story. Rural Utah at a Crossroads is part of the Smithsonian traveling exhibit Crossroads, Change in Rural America, which explores the changing meaning of rural life and identity. Utah Humanities is touring Crossroads to 8 rural communities across Utah in 2024. As part of the tour, Utah Humanities and Utah Public Radio are partnering with exhibition hosts to interview local residents about change in their communities. This interview with Kelly Brooks was recorded at the Granary Arts Gallery in Ephraim, Utah.
I teach visual arts, and I love it. I'm trained in drawing and painting, but I love experimentation. I teach time-based media at Snow College, so video and animation, even performance, those are all things that I enjoy. It's one of the reasons why I really enjoy doing the education workshops with the elementary school kids, is because we get to do printmaking, watercolor, oil pastels. I'm looking around the studio here. We've got all kinds of different projects from our education programming and collage, all kinds of fun stuff. But as a, for myself, drawing, painting, animation, video, those are the mediums that I work in. It's a struggle for people to really support the arts. And I'm all for playing sports and going camping. These are some of the things that I love. But there are a lot of people, including a lot of kids, who benefit from the arts, and it's tough when city funding or other kinds of funding go to recreation and the arts and culture gets left behind. When Amy and I decided that we wanted to propose Granary Arts as a rural arts center in Ephraim, Utah, we went in with our eyes wide open. We understand that, when you have such a small patron base, like, there are going to be challenges there, but we strongly believe in the arts. And I think part of that was being able to have a place that was independent from the college, that could bring contemporary art to this place, to introduce it to not just our students, but the community as well. Putting Granary together, while it was hours and hours, and it's been really like blood, sweat, and tears, for the love, so many hours that just, came from the bottom of our hearts. It's been worth it. And I think Granary has really done well in serving this community as a hub for art and culture and ideas. It's kind of interesting. I mean, San Pete Valley has more artists per capita than any other place in Utah, which is exciting, and I think there's a reason for that. One of the things that I've learned is you find the folks who put their heart and soul into what they do, and you back them. And, I think that, again, that's subjective. Everyone's going to have the things that they value most, it's not a bad way to do things at all, but that's kind of what we've found is really get behind the folks that are committed and dedicated, and that's a way to succeed and thrive here. The only parting words I really have is I find myself still here for lots of reasons, and I don't think there's a week that goes by that I don't express either to someone I know, or even just to, the universe, I'm so glad I get to live here. I love it. I'm very appreciative that places like Ephraim exist, and that we're all working to do our best to make the most of a rural community. Yeah.
Rural Utah at a Crossroads is produced by Maya Shumway. It is a collaboration between Utah Public Radio, Utah Humanities, and the community hosts of Crossroads, Change in Rural America, a Smithsonian Museum on Main Street exhibition made possible in the Beehive State by Utah Humanities. Support for Museum on Main Street has been provided by the United States Congress. Broadcast of Rural Utah at a Crossroads on UPR is supported by our members.